Okay, it's recording? Okay. Something very subtle and important about life and about Avodas Hashem. A little bit of a preface. We live in a world in which sometimes, because family experiences are under siege, frenzied, frazzled world, you don't eat dinner together, you don't see your parents, they don't come home, there's a lot of pressure sometimes. So the family setting isn't as functional and isn't as nurturing as it once was. And one of the fallouts of that is that people have much less self-esteem. Self-esteem is basic to human identity, to prosperity, to well-being emotionally, relationships, the really important parts of life. And self-esteem is defined as you feel good about yourself. You feel that you're a good person, a positive person. You have something to lend to this world. You look at your life with optimism, with confidence. When you think about yourself, your prospects, your life, you wake up, you're happy. Obviously, life has struggles, but there's an inner contentment. There's an inner satisfaction that comes from, I'm worth something, and I'm going to contribute something, and my life has meaning, my life has purpose, and it's working, more or less. Well, at least the parts that I can control. You can't control health, you can't control finance, but the parts that I can control, my character, my being, my relationships, they're working. And when people don't have self-esteem, a lot of abuse kicks in. People who don't have self-esteem try to elicit it from other people in very, very manipulative and exploitative fashion to get them to like them, to get them to adore them. This way I can feel like I'm a celebrity. So many celebrities are emotionally and experientially imbalanced because they just need your attention. They need to have you liking them. They need you to follow them on Instagram. Ideally, the most healthy people in life are people that don't need you. It sounds crazy, but the best people in life will tell you, and I have a million better things to do right now. I'm not here for me. I'm here for you. I'm here to help you. I'm not here to give a good cheer. I'm not here to show like the cheer or not like the cheer. It doesn't mean I don't care about you. It doesn't mean I'm trying to be insensitive to you. But the people that you should flock to most are people that don't need you to like them, because ultimately you should be receiving from them, not giving them your adjuration and admiration. And of course, it's not just that people take it from you, but people who don't have self-esteem allow themselves to be abused and victimized, because at a certain point when people mistreat you, you should say, I don't deserve that treatment. I'm a better person, and you shouldn't treat me that way as your spouse, or shouldn't treat me that way. I deserve a certain amount of dignity and self-respect, which you're not providing in the relationship, and please, you know, make sure you improve yourself. Because sometimes people who are on the victimized end of abuse, they justify through some narrative, well, I'm a failed person, I'm a flawed person anyway, this is my punishment, I deserve this, why should that person treat me better? So self-esteem is really pivotal to growth. Let me take off my mask. Self-esteem is really pivotal, I guess, to growth and to prosperity and inner contentment. But there's a very thin balance between self-esteem and complacency, confidence, invulnerability, can't be wrong. And there's a very thin line of life between confidence and questioning, between doubt and certainty. And it's always more reassuring to have certainty. And it's always more reassuring to have people that grant you certainty and that certify you and that validate you and that affirm you, as we call them, yes men. And that's absolutely crucial. And Amir Hashem, when you choose a wife, in a couple of years, you start that process of you and start already. Part of what you're looking for is a spouse that will affirm you. You can affirm your spouse and believe in her life, that you can believe in your life. But you're also looking for someone to be a whistleblower, someone to introduce doubt, and to cause you to question, and to put your head on a swivel. And those people in life, they're gold. People who can get into your sub-being and create uncertainty in a healthy way, not just to confuse you or to torture you, but really make you think and challenge you and blow the whistle in a healthy way that's respectful, obviously not in a way that's manipulative. Those people are very, very rare. And when you find them, you should realize one of the parts I miss most about Rav Amital is my hand was always on a swivel. Whenever I listened to him, all of a sudden I walked out being less sure of myself than I was before, looking at it from a different angle, and that forced me to have greater conscience and greater thought and greater definition, because I'm always defining myself and questioning myself. This is a very thin line in personal development. We're not speaking about theology now. That's a whole different question. Theologically, how much did you question? How much did you ponder? How much did you just accept? That's a whole different area, because you're not thinking about yourself, but thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And one can make the claim in theory. I'm not saying I subscribe to this claim that no questions should be raised. You should have blind obedience and blind accept. I'm not saying whether I agree or disagree, but it's a whole different halacha. It's a whole different category. I'm talking about development and identity and path in life. Should you be certain? Should you be confident? And Parshas Vayishlach, the opening portrait of Yaakov Avinu, is essentially a study in someone who's not sure. And this is someone who's not sure is on the right side of history and has already been empowered with promises from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and yet he isn't sure and he's afraid. And the word that captures his fear, the very famous word, the very famous drop, the very famous song, still haven't put it out, but at least you'll put it out, Katamti. Katamti. Some of you may know the modern song, Katamti Mikol HaChasadim, or Mikol. It's a beautiful song, but when Israelis sing it, Mikol HaNet. So that's a very emphatic word. It's a word that we all remember. It's a strong cantillation. Katamti. So Yaakov reminds us, and in the specific context, Yaakov is facing Esav and facing a challenge, and issues such as Samchen El Anes or Ein Samchen El Anes emerge because it's under uniquely stressful conditions. And sometimes we simplify Vayishlach. Well, Vayishlach is a great roadmap for how we deal with Arabs and how we deal with world opposition, how we deal with crises facing the Jewish people. And then obviously the message of Yaakov is we can't rely and bank on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem wants us to be cautious. Hashem wants us to be measured. Hashem wants us to daven. Hashem wants us to be pacifist. And certainly, and I'm speaking to those people on the other side of the fence right now, the world that you come from. These guys come from a world called modern orthodoxy. You come from a world called religious Zionism. They're not the same. There's a lot of overlap, but it's not the same. There's a little bit too much confidence in that world, as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu has redeemed us, we're back in our country, we can take any step and be victorious, we have a straight line to Mashiach, and throw caution to the wind. And one of the legacies of the founding Rosh Yeshivas of this yeshiva is redemptive fervor doesn't justify overconfidence and cockiness and reckless behavior. And we don't know when Mashiach is coming, we don't know how it's going to come. And Rav Amital was very cautious because of the Holocaust, because he lived through the horror of the Holocaust, and he felt as if he had to preserve whatever was left. And Rav Lichtenstein was cautious because he's just a cautious person. He was just a very temperate, cautious, measured person. He wasn't reckless, he wasn't impetuous. Rabbi Akiva, when he went to Rome to plead for the Jewish people, very, very sad, sad stories. The Beis HaMikdash had already been destroyed. The Romans were dominating, were crushing the Jewish people with their underfoot. It was a mismatch. It was a total mismatch. And you can imagine them walking into Rome without any leverage. Without any leverage. There's nothing they could offer the Romans or threaten the Romans. It was pure supplication. Obviously, they believed, as we believe, that it's not just, you don't just achieve leverage based on politics and who's got more military might, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu was still supporting his people, even though he discharged us from Yerushalayim. But at least in the political scene, they had no leverage. And they read Vayishlach. Rabbi Akiva would read Vayishlach. He would sit down and read Vayishlach, regardless of what parsha it is. I don't know if they traveled in Vayishlach. It was the winter. Maybe they traveled in the spring. Maybe it was Balosha when he traveled in the summer. But he opened up Vayishlach and he said, let me just read Vayishlach. I just think of Rabbi Akiva every year of Vayishlach. So when I open Vayishlach and I read it, could you imagine Rabbi Akiva on that boat, on the way to Rome, with his knees wobbling, with the fate of whatever was left of the Jewish people hanging in the balance. None of these walking into this big palace, facing these politicians and these emperors that could care less about the dirty Jews, and he had to try to save what he could. It's a very potent and just invigorating read to imagine that now I'm reading it in the state of Israel, in the terms of history, are completely different than what Rabbi Akiva faced. But I want you to read Vayishlach, and I'll help you read Vayishlach through Chazal, not just as a template for how to deal with Rome and how to deal with our enemies in the high-minded sense, politics and international affairs, but personally, how to deal with your own growth. How do you allow doubt and uncertainty to challenge you in a healthy way? My biggest bracha to you is to live with doubt, never to be sure of yourself, never be complacent, never to be locked in and frozen and inert, but to always question yourself. And when you question yourself, it's a sign of your integrity, and to a degree, it's a sign of your confidence. If you're confident in yourself enough to question, to allow questions, you're confident I'll come up with answers and I'll advance and I don't have to take confidence. Some people take confidence in so many externals, politics. Why do you think people are so politicized? Because politics aren't identity. You aren't defined by whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or because it doesn't define you. These are momentary, transient events that we have to deal with. In 200 years, it'll be totally different. I'm sure you know all the Americans here. All the transformations of the Republican and Democratic Party. The Democratic Party used to be for elite, white, rich people, and Republicans were against Islam. And all these parties twist and turn, so you can't really define yourself. But it's easier, because I know who I am. I can check the following boxes. I'm a Republican. I'm a Democrat. I stand for these issues. These are transient, fake, external issues we have to deal with in the real world. But real issues are identity, personality, traits, and for a religious person, eternal identity, eternal traits. But someone's easier. Why do you think people love stamping themselves? I'm Datin Lomi. I'm modern Orthodox. I'm open Orthodox. I'm Haredi. I'm those are cheap solutions to real substantive growth. Stamp yourself and then you live that life and you define yourself. Real identity is assembling it, and you assemble it through hard work and through judging values and questioning yourself and questioning how you should change and how you should grow. How do you live that type of life? What are the voices inside your head? I'm trying to give you voices inside your head that will always assure that you're looking at the mirror of your conscience and you're asking yourself healthy questions. Now, I plead with you, run to friends that challenge you. Run to wives, not wives, but run to a wife. Choose a wife who will challenge you. And say, oh, this is, I run to my challenging wife and I'll find a wife who will challenge you. Find a rabbi. Maybe Saul Salanter. He used to say, any rabbi that they don't want to run him out of town doesn't deserve to be a rabbi. And if they run him out of town, he also doesn't deserve to have a choice. It's hard. It's hard today because shuls are big corporations. There's a lot of money invested. When there's money invested, people, just this past Shabbos, there was something in our kitchen and the food wasn't really cooked properly, so I tried to find a heter. Yes, no, maybe. I paskin, we couldn't eat it. And I was telling Rav Ramon, who gave you a tish, not during the tish, I was telling him the story. He said, yeah, you heard a story of a big shul in New York where one of the board members, one of the big supporters of the shul, made a big kiddush, and they forgot to plug in the chalent. So they asked the guy to plug in the chalent. Now, little may you know, but you can't just skate through Hilchos Shabbos by asking goyim. They're very, very strict halachas about how you ask. And even if you formulate the request in the right way, sometimes you can't eat the food. Depending, again, there are many, 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 many heterim. And most of the issues we face, for example, if it's too cold, you're considered a chol. If it's too hot, you may be considered a chol. If the food was par. But if you take food that mamish wasn't cooked when the guy plugged it in, if he plugs it right in, lefi apashta, so, oh, I can't cook. So they asked the rabbi, and the rabbi said, you can't eat the food for the kiddush. It was the kiddush from one of his children, one of his chasana. He said, you sure that's a psak, rabbi? He said, yeah, you can't eat the food. So that was the last Shabbos, he was the rabbi. Now it's sad, it's the reality, I understand it, but kudos to that rabbi, because how could you be responsible for Chilul Shabbos for hundreds of people? I'll tell you an interesting story. Oh, it's a West Coast story. Long, long time ago, a friend on the West Coast told me the following story. The rabbi got up in shul, started a sermon, everyone's assembled in shul, and he holds up his middle finger. Everyone starts heaving and hoeing and hyperventilating. Mrs. Goldberg is fainting in the top of the balcony. And Mr. Goldsmith is screaming. He's getting more red than Jason Sashura. Everyone is up and up. They call Hatzalah, take some of the older people to the hospital. Finally, all the hot, he stopped. And he says, look at what you've come to. I hold up my tefillin finger, the holiest finger for a yid. And these are the dirty, mucky associations you have. Look how much our culture around us has crept into our hearts. I'm just, it's a tefillin finger. There's nothing wrong with it, it's a tefillin finger. Do you guys even know how the middle finger became associated with a curse? So I'll tell you a little history. In ancient warfare, the most valuable soldiers were the archers. Air Force. Now when you, and archers, I don't mean like bow and arrows. I mean arrows that blinded the sun. You've seen movies and depictions where 500 arrows are shot at once and they pierce your body and they push you against the wall and you crack your skull. And these are real military armaments, military weapons. So what happens if you capture an archer and you want to return the archer to the other side, but you want to disable the archer so he can no longer be successful or valuable in battle? So in Brooklyn, when we would disable someone with kneecap, it's called a kneecap. Well, let your imaginations fill in the blanks, but a kneecap, not too much imagination necessary. If you want to disable a mafia guy, so you cut off his index finger because you can't pull the trigger. And you pull the trigger on a gun. But archers, you cut off their middle finger. Because it's the middle finger that's absolutely necessary to pinch the end of the arrow and pull and create tension. Try pulling an arrow that you can do it, but you really need, with your middle finger, the full force of your hand, of your wrist, to cut off the middle finger. So remember the scenes in all the ancient battles where before the war you try to psych out the opponent by screaming and hooting and hollering and clanging shields and spears. To psych out your opponent, you'd bring all your archers to the front of the line and you'd show them how many archers you had and how you would demolish them and pulverize them with your archers. Now you're at great distances. How would someone show that he's an archer at a great distance? He'd hold up his middle finger. So you'd have thousands of people standing in the front lines holding up their middle finger. This became a sign of aggression. And we're going to defeat you. And we're going to demolish you. So holding up your middle finger became a sign of violence. That's all it is. But for us, it's a tefillin finger. You're holding up the tefillin finger. So this rabbi gave a long, stinging Musar shmooze to the audience about how much culture creep has ruined your minds. And I'm holding up the holiest finger. This is what you're associated with. The next day, the rabbi was called into the office and he was fired. But the joke is, he wasn't fired for flashing the finger. He was fired for giving everyone mussar. Who do you think you are? You're the rabbi. You're supposed to talk about politics. You're supposed to talk about the bar mitzvah girl and how much she loves playing basketball. You're supposed to talk about her parents and how much they're involved in the PTA of the local school. You're not supposed to challenge us. You're supposed to validate us, rabbi. How dare you? How dare you give a mussar shmooze? Now again, it has to be done with a soft hand, because a lot of times when people provide mussar, you feel filthy afterwards. Sometimes they pontificate. Sometimes they disparage you. And it comes out as being very aggressive and doctrinaire and disrespectful. It's so important in life to find people who can challenge you in a way that's disrespectful. That's respectful. In a way that respects who you are, but saying, here are issues I want you to think about. I want you to change in your way, but be honest and face them. Whistleblowers. That's a bracha I give you. You'll always have someone in your life that can provide that. Because it's not easy. It's always easier to be a yes man, because people are friendly to you. If you're a yes man, they like you. They smile at you. If you challenge you to be a man, some people are past being popular. They're not interested in being popular. They're interested in being effective, being valuable to you in your life. So given all that, let's see Yaakov up here. How does Yaakov get there? Not just who gives a mussar. There's no one to give Yaakov a mussar. He doesn't have that rabbi that can challenge him, but it's internal. So how can you also trigger this internally? So the Medrash has two interpretations for Katanti. Source number one, Aleph. Katanti mikol ha-chasadim, amar ba'aba bar kehana. Eni kedai. First of all, healthy sense of proportion. Sometimes we get a little ahead of ourselves. We let our successes get to our head. We see ourselves in ways that we're not. You realize how frail human beings are, how fragile and brittle human life is. I hope and pray that that's one of the long-term legacies of what you're going through, is that your whole life you'll skate on the edge of human fragility, and your life will be so much better. Your life will be so much better having witnessed this pandemic and having witnessed how quickly it could all come crashing down, how razor-thin the boundary between success and failure is. And it's internal. Manu, machayenu, matzidkenu, mayishuasenu. Not just that human beings are frail. Well, human beings are frail, but I'm a pretty good human being. You know, okay, human beings are frail, but I'm the champion human being. It's also internally to be aware of your failure. Sometimes we judge ourselves by our potential. We judge others by their performance. That's why we're harsh judges of other people, and we're very, very kind and generous judges of ourselves. But you realize that you have your own set of failures. Very often, this is the age where you guys are very judgmental to other people. Sometimes people ask me, how do I avoid being so judgmental? How do I look at someone who isn't living up to my expectations and judge them less harshly? So that's a really good question. And just having that question posed to you is half of the answer, just knowing you should pump the brakes on being so judgmental. But sometimes if you look inside yourself and you locate your own flaws, it's a lot easier to climb down off of your roof and off of your soapbox and looking at people. I've got my own flaws, let me deal. A lot of judgmentalism is projection. Projection is a psychological tool that we can help cope with our own flaws. Our flaws are too difficult to look in the mirror and to accept within ourselves. So we project it like you project an image on a screen. You're projecting people around you. So if you're in touch with your own flaws. And this is amazing because Yaakov has really been successful. This is not Yaakov in Vayetze. Yaakov in Vayetze has reason to be humble. He has nothing. No money, penniless, he's been abandoned, no brachos, no aftachos. This is Yaakov, who has four wives, 11 children, very wealthy, has escaped love, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu has spoken to him numerous times. He's seen Malachi multiple. I mean, he's got every reason to be riding the wave of confidence. He's now succeeded. And yet some people let success get to their head and some people don't. And again, there are a lot of externals that can help you with this, exposing yourself to people who have less special needs, elderly people, ill people, proportion, people, I think sometimes people just, when you suffer in life, it's a growing experience. I think people need to fail, and if you haven't failed in life, and some of you have been to this, you've never failed, you've never fallen, your life has been too padded and too easy, and everything is easy, and sometimes when you don't struggle, you don't realize how hard life can sometimes be and how much you should appreciate what you have. So Yaakov's first thoughts of the initial profile of Yaakov is Eini Kedai. Like there's a healthy sense of, and this is Yaakov Avinu speaking. So sensing inadequacy is a good thing. And how you balance between inadequacy and confidence is an art of life. And it's not science. I can't give you a mathematical equation, a dose of this and a dose of that. It's trial and error, but it's having a sense that you're not complete. One of the hard parts for Gush guys to get married is to realize that marriage is about completing yourself. And a lot of people who are very individualistic and confident and successful, it's hard to complete yourself when you don't feel incomplete. Part of coming to yeshiva and really accepting Torah into your bloodstream and into your identity is, do you feel incomplete without Torah? It's a good, healthy question to ask yourself. Maybe one of the big changes between pre-yeshiva and post-yeshiva, you learned Torah before, you attended to religion before because you were raised religiously and you're good boys. But do you feel incomplete without religion? Do you feel like your life is flawed, your life is deficient, empty? Because only when you have that feeling can it sink to the core of whom you are, just like in marriage you'll have to. Only if you feel empty without that other person can that person really complement you and then really become a soulmate, because you feel you can't survive without that person. So first Yaakov thinks about how inadequate and impotent he is. Second thought, the end of the medrash is, kedai, avol katonti mikol ha-chasadim. Now what does that mean? I am kedai, but all the chasadim. So Chazal have two ideas for this. Number one is a Gemara, and number two is a Gemara in Tanya. Two Gemaras. The first Gemara I want to elaborate on more extensively. We'll read the Gemara very quickly. Amr David lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because David HaMelech also expresses concern, uncertainty, even fear. David HaMelech writes in Perek Chav Zayin, Lulei Hamanti Liros B'Tuv Hashem Be'eretz Chaim. I don't know if I'm getting to Olam Haba. Well, if David doesn't know if he's getting to Olam Haba, where are we? David HaMelech is not certain he's got a ticket to Olam Haba. What about your ticket? David HaMelech writes, Ashrei Adam Mefachei Tamid, another pasuk in Tehillim. Why is he so afraid? So look at the Gemara. Amar David, source number base, Ribbono Shel Olam. Muftach ani b'cha shata mishalim sachar tov l'tzadikim lasad lavo. I know that you repay people lasad lavo. Aval eini yodeim yesh li chelik b'neim im lav. I don't know if I'm part of that group. Why? You were the melech. You taught Torah. You wrote Tehillim. You almost built the Beis HaMikdash. You selected Yerushalayim. The following three words. Shema yigrom hachet. I also have sins. I think we've created a world of religion that sometimes feels so smooth and so emulsified that chayt has been defamed. When's the last time you felt traumatized by chayt? When you last sinned, did it strike you to the core? Or did it elicit a sense of, well, no pain, no gain, I blew it, but I'll get back on the horse tomorrow, back on the wagon tomorrow, Zeraiza. Now, don't get me wrong. I think previous generations, especially the Holocaust, when I look at my grandparents and I think about how they viewed religion, some of the voices I heard, there's a lot of guilt and a lot of fear and a lot of trauma because they lived through trauma. So their whole life was pivoted around trauma. And I think that we created a fresher, more smiley form of Judaism. Think about the Judaism you were taught. Be a better person, have a better family life, have a life full of meaning, redeem yourself, transform yourself, enrich yourself, better. Which is great, because I think we needed that turnaround. But have we turned around too radically? Has chayt lost some of its impact on us? Let me ask you a different type of question. Here are some chatayim you may perform where you did feel like, oh my goodness, you felt jarred. I know that if, let's say, I eat milk by accident too quickly, it really hurts me. It really impacts me. Because why? Because I put it into my body. If I'm like, it's not just, I'm saying this facetiously, it's not just Lashon Hara or just the Chet or just, but I put in Basar B'Cholam into my body. Now I have to live with Basar B'Cholam in my body. It's very jarring for me. What other Chatayim do I find jarring when I miss a Mincha? I feel like, wow, this, I miss that guy. I can't believe it. Generally, when my schedule shifts and you don't realize you miss a Mincha. Shouldn't every Chet be like that? Shouldn't every Chet be... It arouses shame or guilt or frustration. And if that doesn't happen, you're living outside of conscience. You're living outside of corrective capacity. They say about the Vilna Gaon that on his deathbed he was shivering. And they said, "You're the Vilna Gaon." Like, I mean, they say it like this. What's up? Why are you shivering? And he said he remembered about 15 years ago, I don't know the exact details, but 20 years earlier, he was Mevatel Torah. Now, I'm not sure whether it was 15 minutes, 20 minutes, or 20 seconds. Now, I don't know that we can live up to the Vilna Gaon standards. But he was able to create some general time expectation surrounding Avodas Hashem, that when you fail to live up to your standards, there's some shock, there's some movement inside, there's something has to change. Sometimes boys, you don't go back to base medrash environments, ask me, how can I secure my Talmud Torah? Because it's the hardest thing when you fall. Look how you're falling this year. Naturally, you always fall, you always have weak days, you always have a lack of enthusiasm. So the environment is here just to pick you back up. You know, the base medrash is a place to be, and that's where everyone is, and you just slide right back into it. What happens when I don't have that framework? So sometimes I tell people, it's a tried and true approach. Set yourself a certain quota of hours per day that you're going to learn. Let's call it 2 hours. Let's say that's all you can learn in a secular environment. And then every day you fail to meet your quota, either you have to make it up the next day, which is really the Daf Yomi secret, because you can't miss a day because then you have a gaping hole, so you have to make it up the next day. Or find yourself $5. Just so that there's a mechanism that religion just doesn't become, you know what, best foot forward, I tried my best, A for effort, it's all fine, everyone gets an award at graduation, you know, everyone gets a medal after the season's over, because it's all good, because everyone's fine, and everyone's rosy, and we accept everyone, and we embrace, and one big tent, and everyone's, which is a great policy at a social level, but not such a great policy at a personal level, because then it clips, and it truncates your achievement. So is chet, is that whole world of chet, does it feel toxic? Does it feel, is it something that creates an unnerving? And again, every one of these things has to be carefully balanced. Because if it leads to despair, and if it leads to self-doubt that's crippling, but I'm trying to correct what I feel is an imbalance in the way you were raised. I had it a little bit different. I think I had too much guilt in the way I was raised. I was raised by Holocaust survivors. Those are my rebbeim. I was raised in a Haredi environment in which any minute you blew, if you weren't learning Torah, you're going to burn in sulfuric ashes. And I have this little clock always ticking inside of me. Tick-tock, tick-tock. The clock. Tick-tock, tick-tock. To always make sure that am I justifying my time. I don't live up to that standard, but it's a faint echo that I feel driven by. So Yaakov's second level is not just inadequacy, personal inadequacy, but I have my failures. And he's haunted by failures, and he's haunted by even perceived failures. I'm sure he's still trying to get past the Stele Yeses Brachos, and these aren't real failures because he followed his instructions, but he's uneasy about it. Doubt to the scholar, or doubt to the layman, is integrity to the scholar. If you're a scholar, if you're a really good person, then doubt is good, doubting yourself and questioning yourself. How many people in your world don't have moral authority they listen to? How many people are self-arbitrators morally? How many of the adults in your life don't have voices that they would listen to? When Lichtenstein said something, I listened so carefully to what he said to me when I asked him for personal advice. I didn't always agree with it. He didn't always force me to agree with it. But I churned over it, and I pondered it, and I thought about it, and I said, you know what, aren't there people like that in your life that you don't want them to impose a decision or dictate a decision, but you want their feedback and say, okay, now I'll think about it, and I'll think about it really good. Because really hard, because I don't want to think about it, it's going to lead to sharper identity, deeper meaning, deeper. And the third, which I'm not going to elaborate on now, is Yaakov says, which is a simple pshat, I've just received so much from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that who knows if my merit has run out. Free lunches. What do I do to deserve this? I think everyone in our generation maybe should pose that question. What did we do to deserve this? We're 80 years away from Auschwitz, 80 years away from Treblinka. So it's not like it was a different era. It's our era. The movies are black and white. The films are black and white. But it's the same. It's not a different era. It's two generations, three generations. Why did Hashem put me where he put me? Why did he put them where he put them? It wasn't just happenstance. It wasn't just random. If you had a very comfortable upbringing, then why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu give you such comfort? There's nothing random in life. HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes these decisions. They're meticulous, carefully honed decisions. So I'm turning the doubt of Yaakov into a charge of mission. Okay, it's not just to worry that maybe you and your family are running out of zechios and you're about to meet a train wreck and a traffic accident in Chas V'Shalom in Kansas. And no, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me so much. It's a platform. He's platforming me. If he's platforming me, he must have expectations for me to use this platform. And if I don't use that platform, then I have to be haunted. Like, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me so much just to... I think it's really at the heart of this yeshiva is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is platforming us, and those platforms carry expectations, and how will you take advantage of those expectations and become something great and do something really meaningful with everything, the resource Hashem has given you, or else it's a waste of resources. If you don't use them in a way that's selfless and it's idealistic, however you'll define that. I'm not pigeonholing you to be this or that, or live here or live there, but are you going to choose to dream, and are you going to choose the life of sacrifice? It's a good word, life of sacrifice. That could be translated to many, many. It doesn't mean how much money you earn. It just means, do you live for something else or do you live for yourself? Do you live for something else? And that something else should be roughly traceable to the world of Avodas Hashem. So for one person, it's living in Israel. For one person, it's working really hard to raise his families over the Hashem. For one person, it's commitment to Talmud Torah. For some people, they can combine all three of them. For another person, but just, you're not just living to have an easier experience, an easier lifestyle. You're living for something deep, and believe it's, it's really the secrets of raising children. Raising children succeeds more when kids see passion in parents. And one of the differences between modern orthodoxy and religious Zionism, to my eyes, again, I'm not an expert sociologically, I think it's harder for kids who were raised in modern orthodox world to sense passion. I'm not saying it's not there, I'm just saying it's harder to sense it. More complicated, maybe it's not there, maybe it's there in less doses. I'm not saying whether it is or isn't there, I just don't know the kids discern it as easily. Here in the religious Zionist world, there's a lot of passion. It may be poured into the wrong areas, it may not be balanced properly, but kids sense by and large that my parents are trying to live a passionate life dedicated to values, and that's inspiring. That makes kids be those types of children when they grow older. Yeah, my parents lived for something, and okay, I'll pick something else, as long as it wasn't shoved down their throat. When it's shoved down your throat, you tend to rebel. So I don't want to, you shove this ideology down my throat, I'll rebel and I'll find something else, but as long as it's done with respect and friendship and kindness, and kids are attracted to that when they want to become idealistic, when they want to chart their own lives. So it's an important parsha to read, it's an important word to read, and it's an important concept to try to work at. Be confident. You're very successful boys. I think you'll continue to be successful. You'll meet a lot of achievements, but find the parts in your life that make you humble. Find the parts in your life that introduce doubt. Find the parts of your life that retain a healthier self-image that's predicated both on self-esteem, but also on, you know, just not believing too much in yourself. So I think it's healthy when you get a little tired and you don't cave as soon as you get tired. Because when you're tired, I'm exhausted right now. I can hardly speak straight. I'm talking, my head's spinning. And you realize that, you know, the difference between a more successful you and a less successful you is 2 hours of sleep. That's how much you fall. If you sleep 2 hours less, you'll be confused in days. You know, there's more you'll be. So you realize it. And it's healthy to proceed during that day because things don't come as easy to you. You're not as successful. You're not at the top of your game. You're like, okay, so that's good. It's good sometimes to fail. It's good sometimes not to succeed as much as you wanted to because it gives you a truer sense of whom you are. Okay. Second message tonight. Keeping an eye on the clock. Second message tonight. The Dina box. Very famous question. The Dina box. V'dina heichan haisa. Where was Dina? Very famous question. Torah enumerates all the children, all the wives. V'dina, heichan hu, heichan haisa, heichan hi. Natna b'teva v'nal b'fonea. Yaakov locks up Dina in a box. Dina in a box. Sounds like a Dr. Seuss story. Dina in a box. Why? So Esav, I get the wrong idea. Right. Esav's always looking to marry. What have Yaakov said? Rachel is going to marry Rachel. And Rashi says last week when Yaakov divorces her because she's barren, can't marry Rachel, marry Dina. Esav, one little piece of the action. One's in on Yaakov's family. He'll marry whatever he can, whatever scraps he can get, he'll marry. Maybe Dina was attractive. So you all know the Medrash. We all heard the Medrash. We all studied the Medrash and the danger of exposure to Rishayim and the danger of Esav and the protective measures of Yaakov. Did you read the end of the Medrash? I don't know if your Rebbe's ever taught you the end of the Medrash. And for good reason, because when you're younger, you need to hear the primary message. But there's a secondary message. And now that you're 18, you have to hear the secondary message, because 18 is about balance. 12 is about black and white. 18 is about balance. So now you're 18. You have to meet that balance in life. HaKadosh Baruch Hu chides Yaakov. And I'll just read it very quickly. Second to last line. Lo bikashta lahasiya lamahol. This was your chance, Yaakov, for Dina to get married to someone that had Mila. He said, had Mila, grew up in Yitzchak's house. Harinis is Leorel. So she's going to be raped by a person without Mila. Lo bikashta lahasiya derech heter. You could have married her to Esav with a heter. Harinis is derech eser. She's going to be raped. And just to quote the middle pasuk, Lamas merieu chasid. It's a pasuk in Eov, fourth line. Yaakov, stop playing defense. This is your chance to convert Esav. He may marry Dina, but you're strong enough to bring Esav into the family and to change history. How would history have changed if Esav marries Dina? Would the Crusades have happened? Would the Holocaust have happened? So much of what Western civilization was responsible for. Yaakov is being so cautious with Dina, so insulated with Dina, that Hashem punishes him and says, your punishment is that Dina is going to be raped. Now we'll talk about why that was the punishment, but now all of a sudden you're 18 years old. Now it raises the following question. It's a big E word. Exposure or encounter. How much of it should I have? How much of it should I not have? Should I be Dina in a box, protected and preserved from my surroundings? Or should I be someone that's able to inspire my surroundings and give to others? Oh boy, that's a really, really important question. And a lot of boys get it wrong. You have to know where you are in life, what resources you have at your disposal in life. Generally, boys in this yeshiva get it wrong because they aren't in the box enough. I'm in college, I feel very confident about myself, I want to be an Or LaGoyim, I can spread the word, I can teach people. It's hard. It's really hard when you're alone. You'll see this. You have to place so much energy just into sustaining, preserving that. Rabbi Sacks, Zichrono Livracha, used to talk about the metaphor of the airplane. I think I quoted this to someone the other week. He said, my young man, he once answered a person who asked him this question in a meeting, not a meeting, but like a gathering, public gathering. Have you never been on an airplane? Been on an airplane. Have you not been listening to the stewardesses in his British accent? The stewardess's instruction. The stewardess's instruction. What does she say? In case the cabin becomes depressurized, oxygen masks will drop from the ceiling. Make sure you affix your oxygen mask to yourself before you come to the aid of others. That's more or less a word-by-word quote. I know these things by heart. First, make sure you have oxygen. You're still during the time of your life where you need oxygen, where you need input, where you need inspiration. You're still vulnerable. You're still impressionable. The thought that you're going to inspire the world has to be checked with a healthy dose of, am I ready? Your identity is still, like Terry, you're in the jello age. It's still jello. It's still shimmying. It's still settling. It's still consolidating. When you're a little bit older and you know who you are and you're married and your identity is more sturdy, then you can't open yourself to other people. Think about it on a yeshiva level, not just a personal level. I think this yeshiva tries. I can't compare it to other yeshivas. It's a broad spectrum, and Israel occupies one part of the spectrum. In America, another part. I was having a conversation with Reb Mechi, one of the Israeli rabbis, about how we're seen in America and how we're seen in Israel. It's totally different, because in the Hesder world, the perch we occupy is very, very different from the perch we occupy in America. It's because the scenes are very different. But I think that in this yeshiva, there's a tilt Certainly when I compare ourselves to the American yeshivas, I'm not talking to the Israelis now about the Israeli yeshivas, I'm talking to the Americans about the yeshivas that their peers go to. There's more of an attempt to create diversity, I think. I know that I look for that. There's more of a willingness to accept boys from Saudi. Again, I can't compare our acceptance list to other yeshivas. I just know what I'm looking for and what the word on the street sometimes is. But that's executable because there's a core energy in this Beis Medrash, which unfortunately it's harder to feel when the Beis Medrash is divided into small little cantons. But I know that in the end of the day, I'm not telling you this because I want to laud my yeshiva or toot the yeshiva's horn, I'm just trying to give you a structural model. Because in the end of the day, there are 25 Shir Vav guys and 25 Shir Zayin guys sitting and going through Shas and 50, 80 people in the Kollel. So the direction of this yeshiva, written large, is going to be very, very powerfully driven towards Torah and Yirat Shamayim and Avodas Hashem, and that's the tone. If I take this boy or that boy, it's not going to really change the tone of the yeshiva. It may change his tone, and I'm going to try to change him. So you have to ask yourself whether you're impressionable, what resources you have at your disposal, can you not? Don't make a simple decision. By and large, my own feeling is, by and large, during these next couple of years, you should err on the side of caution than on the side of ambition. Protect yourself for your children. You haven't met your children yet. I know it's a strange word, but I can see your children. That sounds a little creepy if I say it differently. I can see the people behind you who will one day become your children because I've lived a longer life, so I can see the people you'll become. And the biggest mistake you can make is, well, I'm on this college campus for 3 years. Don't I have responsibilities? They say, no, you have responsibilities to the people you're going to spend your whole life with. You just don't see them yet. Okay, so it's a balance. You can't snub your surroundings. You just walk away. And if you feel sometimes when you're contributing on your communal campuses, sometimes you're actually strengthening yourself because when you contribute, that's a self-affirming moment. So it's not really black and white, yes or no. But just think carefully. Judge yourself. Correct yourself. Okay, now that I've spent a semester involved in, has it created more Yerusha, called the Yerushamayim odometer. More Yerushamayim. It's pretty simple. You have to be honest to apply it. More Yerushamayim, less Yerushamayim. It doesn't have to be more complicated than that. Am I more Yerushamayim or less Yerushamayim? And if you feel that you are precipitously falling off the Yerushamayim odometer, then it's time for a reboot. And it's time to contract a little bit. It's time to find your box. If you feel you're stronger and you can open your box a little bit and try to find, I don't want to say the Asaphs in the world because that's pernicious. Those would be Asaphs in the world. The people who just could use a little bit of inspiration. Don't shut people down. Some people in this world are too insular and they're depriving other people of real meaning and real growth and real inspiration. Have a little confidence in yourself. Don't live a life of fear and vulnerability. Sometimes it can be a self-fulfilling narrative. I'm vulnerable, I'm afraid, I'm impressionable. If you keep telling yourself that, you will be. If you tell yourself at a certain point when it's appropriate, no, I'm pretty strong, I have a wife, I have a family, I pretty much know who I am, even at an early age. It doesn't have to be when you're 45, it could be when you're 25. It could be now, depending upon the context. Some people thrive in the army because the army forces them to define themselves as different. Here in yeshiva, it's harder to feel special because everyone's rowing in the same direction. In the army, you're rowing backward. You're rowing different from the you're rowing in a different direction, and you feel like I got to row the boat against the uphill rowing. That's why sometimes when you're in different locations, sometimes the best of you can come out. So I can't tell you a general rule. As I said, it's not math, it's not science. I can't put it on paper and give you a formula. But just be aware. Every message, you're at the stage now, you've been here long enough to know that almost every message we give is a message of balance. Here are the messages that aren't a question of balance. How much Torah should you learn? As much as you possibly can. Not a question of balance. Oh, I want to be balanced in my Torah. No, you should learn Torah with as much of you can. How should I daven with your whole passion? How should I keep mitzvahs with as much verve as I can? How should I get stuck as much as you can? How should I work on those aspects, there should be no limitation. There should be no qualification. But character identity, when the Rambam talks about the middle road, he's not talking about how much Torah you should. I'm a Rambam man. I learn a little bit. I don't learn that much. I'm a Rambam man. I go to shul, but I don't want to daven that much kavanah because I'm a Rambam man. I go to shul, I'll talk a little, I'll daven a little. Everything in moderation, right? Everything in moderation. I can follow the poor Rambam is turning over his grave. The Rambam talks about personality, confidence, doubt, exposure, insulation. Are you happy all the time, or are you serious all the time? Do you spend all your money? It's about how you build your character. Not how you perform a mitzvah, not how you daven, not how you learn Torah, not how it's your shemayim. You know, just be careful. Poor Rambam. They become the flag. Anyone that wants to excuse flaccid or lame, Hodes Hashem. Okay, so we have 3-4 minutes. So let's just talk about the third message tonight. So what was Dina's punishment? The punishment of Dina was a punishment. It's not really a punishment, guys. It's a reality. Vatese Dina Basleya Shayodu Liakov Lerozbiv Nosaretz. Why is Vatese Dina Basleya? All of a sudden, Basleya. Right. Remember when your mom gets angry at you? What does she say? Says to your father, your son! I says, your son also. Hey, your son just... What, my son? You're my son. Last I checked, you're the mother also, right? But your son just... Tetz Edina Basleya. That's Leah's fault. Leah's fault. As far as I checked, Yaakov's the dad here. So Chazal say, because Leah was also very curious, and she went out, Vayetetze Leah, Vayetze, so... Dina's a little too curious. Tetz Edina Basleya. Afhi yatz on his hoise, Rashi, source Gimel 2. Since Leah was Vatetze Leah Likroso, so Vatetze Dina Basleya. Chazal I'll say very briefly that Leah was entrapped. Why was she entrapped? A little too curious, her own good. So, you know, what's on the other side there? What are local townsfolk? They just pitched their tent from the outskirts of town. They go for a little walk through town, see what I could find. And she got raped. Made a wrong turn down the wrong alley. Now, why are Chazal telling us this? Because again, here's the third balancing act of tonight. Curiosity. Who won the curiosity award in high school? The intellectual curiosity award. He's so intellectually curious. He's such intellectual, he's such curiosity. It's great to want to learn and grow and discover. Some people have a dearth of lack of curiosity. They're dry inside. They're too complacent. There's no desire to learn, to grow, to explore, to discover. But in 2020, curiosity will doom you. You have to learn how to draw red lines. You have to learn how to apply curiosity in balance. And say, okay, this is something I should be curious about, something I shouldn't explore. Not everything has to be run down and explored. Wisdom on one hand, caution on the other hand. You want to explore and uncover. So when you raise your kids, and when you build a world for yourself, it shouldn't be an absolute open market of ideas and everything is placed on the table, and then Shmuley's board come and decide who you want to be. Sometimes when people get angry, oh, those people, those, whatever, they indoctrinate their kids. Propaganda. They shape their mind. They brainwash. Guys, religious instruction is about brainwashing. Difference is style. I use the word brainwashing. Connotes manipulation. And I don't introduce everything at every moment to my kids. I'll just figure out, okay, here's an open door, an open portal, take whatever you want and make decisions. Not democracy. They do it in a way that's gradual, in a way that's holistic. They want them to grow. Part of the problem with Dina is that if you don't have any curiosity because you put someone in a box, then the second they enter the broader world and they see there's a broader world out there, they don't have an equation that's sturdy enough to withstand these new ideas. So sometimes if you're too insular and people haven't seen the world around them, then when they finally do see the world around them, they fall like a house of cards, like a stack of dominoes. So here too, should I create exposure to my kids? Not exposure to the other. That was the previous conversation. Exposure to the Asavs, exposure to the people that need my inspiration, but just to ideas, to culture, to the world around me. But curiosity can't have a capital C. The greatest mistakes in life is when people take partial values and assign to them absolute evaluation. There are very few absolute values. You know what they are, and you know what they are. Torah, Tefillah, Chesed, Yirat Shamayim, Avas Hashem, Avas Am Yisrael, Avas Haaretz, those are absolutes. Everything else is a variable. And it's a variable in a complex equation that you have to strike a balance. That's why I encourage you really, really hard to focus on the absolutes in life. Not to focus on everything else like politics and ideology, and it's all just a wave. Come in and come out, and wash in and wash out. It seems important to you, but it's a mirage. It seems important. Everyone likes talking about it, but it's a mirage. Let's dive in. Okay. Let's go to bed.